Hello everyone. Today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Now, I'm someone that likes to keep things quite organized, or at least certain things organized. And I realized that my trip to Cambodia has set back what I guess we could call the regular scheduled programming of the podcast. We're going to be doing more videos, more interviews, things like that. I've already spoken about this previously. I won't go into it again, but to watch all of this stuff, yes, some will still be on YouTube, some will just be on Patreon. You don't even have to, I think, even sign up to Patreon to watch some of it. It will just be there, so you can click on a link and watch it right there. That being said, there's a lot of people on YouTube, so if they want to watch it with ads, that's up to them. But again, in a slight departure from the regular programming, as much as I would like to get to the next part of the story, the 1972 post-Chen La offensive era, where the Khmer Rouge really took the civil war up for themselves, and the Vietnamese, having conquered most of Cambodia for the Khmer Rouge, allowed their comrades to take over the fighting. We will get there. I promise you that. But as if you've been paying attention, as you know, I am here. I am back in Cambodia. And over the last weekend, I spent a significant amount of time in the west of Cambodia, a place I'd never been to before. Battambang, Pai Lin, Sam Lao, and Malai. Now, all of these places have been what you could consider strongholds for the Khmer Rouge at various times in the story that we have covered in the podcast. But what we haven't covered in the podcast, because we're still stuck in 1971, is what happened in the 80s and the 90s. So I know that a lot of you do have a working knowledge of what happened in the post-democratic Kampuchea period, but I also know that some people are just finding out this information as I explain the story. But, as I said, today we're doing something a little different, and it's based on the work I was doing in Pai Lin and Malai and Sam Lao over those few days. I was able, for the first time, to speak with ex-Khmer Rouge. Now, for various reasons, which I won't get into, there were topics that were off the table that we weren't to discuss. Politics, as I was explained before these conversations took place. Now, again, I won't really get into this too much, but let's just say that what I thought they meant by politics, I had presumed would mean that they wouldn't like to discuss certain things that happened during democratic Kampuchea from 1975 to 1979. It turns out these sensitive topics are actually what happened afterwards. So we'll kind of leave it there, but today, if you're watching this, this should work as an audio. I'm going to release it just as audio I'll also release it as a video. There'll be a couple of, you know, pictures I can put up throughout. So if you're watching this or listening to this, we're going to be doing something a bit different. Basically, of the four interviews I conducted, I have spent the last few days reorganizing those notes. None of the interviews were recorded, so all of my notes were handwritten. So it took me quite a while to go back and make sure that I could make sense of my own handwriting, for starters, and to also put these conversations into a more accessible flow that I can use for when I'm writing the book. Now, today, I'm going to read you the recontextualized notes of someone that I will refer to as Uncle at times, because he was a contact of a contact's uncle. That doesn't necessarily mean a relative, but someone who acts in an avuncular fashion, if we want to put it in Western terms. Now, I'll also refer to him as a Khmer Rouge doctor at times throughout this as well. He wished to remain anonymous, and as I mentioned, there are reasons for some of these people to want to remain anonymous. So, I believe the interview took place over about 2 to 3 hours, which can be a taxing thing to do, especially for my interpreter and me trying to write things down. And what really happened was this man wanted to tell his story. He was very intelligent, very kind. Like I said, he was a doctor, a Khmer Rouge doctor. And as you'll find out, quite an interesting person. So if we want to call this sort of story time with Lachlan, this is a bonus episode. It may be behind a paywall. It may not be behind a paywall. I haven't decided. I do want as many people as possible to be able to see this, but we'll see. So let's get into it. This uncle was born in Krache province, which is in the east of Cambodia. And the interview was conducted on the 23rd of September, 2015, in Pai Lin, in a doctor's office. As I mentioned before, because we were keeping him anonymous, the job title that I wanted to establish with him, like what I could refer to him if I was to use him as a source in the book, for instance, we settled on a Khmer Rouge doctor. He was born in 1953, the year of independence. And the interview began with his education. He had been educated. It wasn't exactly clear with some of the interpretation to what level. There's sort of what grade 3 means to someone in the West isn't quite what it means in Cambodia, but he had received an education. In 1970, the coup, which if you've been listening to the podcast, you'll know all about, meant that the university that he was studying at, I believe he was studying medicine, was shut down. Many teachers felt that this was a moment that they should disperse. As we mentioned, this was a chaotic period, And after the coup, as we went into in great depth, essentially that whole part of the country was overnight engulfed in war. He had heard the Sihanouk announcement over the radio, the call to arms for his people to join this new front to take back Cambodia. And he had even joined in protests in Kampong Cham, which is southwest of Kratchez. They were chanting that they wanted the king back, just like the king had asked them to do, right? He was arrested, but seemingly let go quite quickly. And he fled back home to Kratchez. Now, by May 1970, so remember that the coup occurs on the 18th of March 1970. So by May 1970, Kratchez had been liberated. The Vietnamese had done the fighting, but they had given the administration of Kratchez to the Khmer Rouge. By the end of May, he and other students joined the nationalist, you know, front, ostensibly to bring Sihanouk back to power, right? Remember, this wasn't joining the Khmer Rouge per se. This was joining a nationalist coalition to bring the king back to power. He said he did it for Sihanouk. He joined the Maquis, which, remember, means basically fleeing to the forests to join up with the guerrillas. And there he met a teacher who had been very close to him in 1967. That teacher, that year in 1967, had actually disappeared into the Maquis as well. And if you'll recall from the podcast in 1967, that was around the time of the Sam Lau uprising. That was around the time that Sihanouk had a major crackdown against this rising threat that he felt was coming from the left. And it was apparent that this teacher, who had actually been part of the Khmer Rouge for a long time, decided that it was time that he fled to the Maquis, like many others did in 1967. It was a pivotal year. So as I said, this teacher had actually been a Khmer Rouge member for some time. Now, his code name was Yam. And I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but how it is usually spelt is Y-E-A-M. Yam. His real name is harder to come by. Uncle said it was something like San Son, but from the research I've subsequently done, it seems harder to exactly know his real name because of how many different code names there were out there. There is some confusion to someone else who had a similar code name, so let's just forget his real name for the moment, and from now on we'll refer to him as Yam. Now, Craig Etchison, in his submission to the Khmer Rouge tribunals, he did a very thorough breakdown of the Khmer Rouge hierarchy and essentially how the Khmer Rouge administration worked. And as I was reading through that document, he did mention a Yam who ran the office of K4 in Phnom Penh, which was a logistics office. He was also the Khmer Rouge administrator of Kratchez province, sort of before the liberation of Phnom Penh. So throughout the Civil War, probably predating it, he was basically the Khmer Rouge's top man in Krachet. And he was also made in 1976 Democratic Kampuchea's ambassador to North Korea. Now, one other Khmer Rouge tribunal dossier notes that Yongyam, which is a common thing, like Pol used to go by just Pol and then he added Pol Pot. This was a common thing that Khmer Rouge cadre did. They would sort of add an extra sort of consonant to their name, the reasons of which we don't need to get into, but Yongyam was the zone secretary of Krachet province prior to 1975. So what Uncle was telling me, we can verify from other sources. Back to the interview. Now, in the Marquis, Yam, having recalled his former student, who he used to teach 4 years prior, 3 years prior, he seemed to kind of take him under his wing. Quote, he said, "Stay with me." And this uncle claimed Yam was administrator of this area, which the Khmer Rouge named zone or administrative zone 505. And again, that's confirmed in other sources. Now, the interview basically followed his biography, but at points I asked him questions which actually distracted him from telling his story chronologically. I'm still getting used to doing these interviews. I was looking for specific information, and at that point in the interview, I hadn't realized that we'd really sat down for this guy to just tell me his story. So that was his main goal, was to just explain his story. So sometimes I would interject with a question and he would basically say, "We'll get to that. Just let me get to where we are." So you'll notice that a few times. But in this instance, I asked him about the bombing from 1970 to 1973. And he said he was, quote, "not afraid. It simply became, quote, normal." I also asked him about the effect of the bombing compared to the pull of Sihanouk, which, if you've been listening to the podcast, has been something that I've been trying to point out. A lot of people have pointed to the bombing as if it was the only reason that the Khmer Rouge were able to gather so many new recruits. What I think is often lost in that is Sihanouk's effect in that same process. He said it was both. He had been young, his parents were pro-Sihanouk, and after the coup, he wanted to defend Sihanouk. Excuse me. He recalled a specific instance where a bridge was bombed on Route 7. Now, I had a look on Google Maps. Route 7's a long road. It was hard to say exactly where this bombing may have occurred. Perhaps Stung Treng. There's a bridge there on Route 7 that goes over a small river. Again, I can't say for sure, but he stated that it was Lon Nol's army that dropped that bomb, and the effects of it were to, you know, drive recruitment toward the Khmer Rouge, because you can say, hey, the government is bombing our own people, perhaps you should join in with us. So again, we get this both-sided thing. We have the pull of Sihanouk, and we have a government and the United States bombing the country and pushing people toward violent uprising. Back to his story. 1970, May. After being in the Marquise for a month, he went back to Cratchit. He had been told by Ankar to go back and continue studying. Yeam had told him to study for the movement. Ankar had instructed him to continue his studies. Here we went on another tangent. He had heard of the Khmer Rouge prior to 1970 in newspapers, radio. He remembered Khieu Samphan being accused in 1967, which, again, if you can go back and listen to the podcast on the Samlaut uprising, we really dived into Khieu Samphan's sort of being blamed by Sihanouk publicly at that time, and Khieu Samphan having to flee, along with the other so-called three ghosts, Hu Nim and Hu Yun. He recalled each of the three ghosts by name, which I thought was interesting, because it was one of the few times where, not knowing Khmer, at least I could recognize when he said Hu Nim, Hu Yun. So at least I felt like I was part of the conversation there. I think at this point I asked if he wanted to move on a bit, as we had been talking for at least an hour and we were still in 1970. This was rebuffed. And that's what I mean about my poor interviewing skills and realizing that he really just wanted to tell his story. So he continued his story. So back in Cratchit studying, he was studying for roughly 2 months. He was now told to train as a soldier as well. He suggested there were already functions of, I use the word governance here, that wasn't his phrase, but he referred to different ministries and ways of administration being set up in Cratchit. So remember when this is all happening. Mid-1970, there are places in Cambodia that are simply under communist control. The Vietnamese had done the fighting. They'd handed over the administration to the Khmer Rouge. So this was around July, August, and September 1970. And he confirmed that at this point, only the Vietnamese were doing the fighting, which we've established on the podcast as well, haven't we? He said that during this period, Khmer Hanoi returnees, remember, there were plenty of what we've called the Khmer Viet Minh that stayed in Hanoi at this point for more than a decade. And at this point, they were being told to return to Cambodia. We've covered this in the podcast, but I just wanted to remind you that when I say the Hanoi returnees, that's who we're talking about. We're talking about Khmer that had been trained in Vietnam for a long time, and, well, we'll get to it in the podcast soon enough, but they will very quickly be purged by the Khmer Rouge. We'll get there eventually. As I said, he said during this period, Khmer Rouge Hanoi returnees were teaching him to fight. Then he was sent back to study. Sent back to study medicine. He said he had three types of teachers: Hanoi Khmer, China Khmer, and Soviet Khmer. But they were all Cambodians, that they had just been in these different socialist countries. toward the end of 1970, I'm thinking around November, he was chosen with three boys and two girls to be sent to Kampong Tom. They walked from Cratchit to Prayer Vihear, and the base that they were eventually sent to was near the Kampong Tom Prayer Vihear border. So I'm guessing north-ish Kampong Tom. I'll put a map up here to give you a general idea if you're watching this on video. And they eventually get there in December. After arriving at a village, the base, as it were, was one more day of walking away from where they got to. This place of study. It was, like I said, near that northern border with Prayer Vihear. Now, I'll just interject for a moment here. At this point, I asked him if he knew that Pol Pot had recently relocated his headquarters to a similar area in Kampong Tom. This question, either through interpretation or simply aloofness, was not really answered, but in my mind, it certainly made sense that, if you'll recall from one of the previous podcast episodes, Pol Pot had set up his new base of operations to fight this civil war in Kampong Tom once he had come back from Hanoi in the middle of 1970. And you'll also recall the meeting that he had with the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese communists about establishing the kind of ways forward that they wanted to do. They didn't want the Vietnamese to be administering everything. They wanted to be doing their fair share of the fighting. And they also didn't want the Vietnamese Hanoi Khmer returnees to be placed in these positions of administration, because of course that would put Pol Pot's own administration in an uneasy place. So I think it's no coincidence that Uncle was summoned to Kampong Tom at the end of 1970, probably following that meeting that Pol Pot had had with the communist Vietnamese to establish these new rules. You'll also recall that later Pol Pot will have accused some of his own highest cadre of a Vietnamese plot to poison him during this meeting, but that's neither here nor there. But for me, it was very interesting to hear that someone who lived this history was mapping up completely with the history I knew. It was fascinating. He worked at a jungle hospital, and he said it was the main hospital of the Khmer Rouge, which again makes sense if you consider that Pol Pot's base of operations now is in Kampong Tom. He was not aware of Pol Pot's base, but it makes sense that the main hospital of the Khmer Rouge, in his words, was somewhat close to Pol Pot's own base of operations. Then he specifically mentioned the 24th of December, 1970, where his class was officially announced at a kind of ceremony as the first graduating class of Khmer Rouge doctors. A quote. It was a class of about 30, and he said that the people, the students, had been summoned from all of the liberated areas from across the country. But he did make the point that his group from Cratchit, the five of them, was the most that had come from one province. Usually there was only one or two that had come from these other provinces. He said that Hun Nim had photographed the ceremony, and that Nuon Chea was the speaker, as it were. There were four or five other leaders at the time that were present, but at the time he didn't know who Nuon Chea was, who was giving this, you know, you can imagine, you know, any typical graduation ceremony, someone giving the speech. He didn't know that Nuon Chea, well, he didn't know who Nuon Chea was, let alone his position. He soon found out who Nuon Chea was, that he was number two, and through conversations with his compatriots, he became that there was a higher leader and that that was Pol Pot. So he was aware that Pol Pot was the leader of the party as early as the end of 1970. At this point, there was a brief interlude, as I asked if he thought that more students had been summoned from Kracher due to the influence of Yayam, his teacher. He agreed. He seemed to think that, well, Yayam having such a high position in the party, perhaps he was trusted, and his suggestion of these students from Kracher was taken quite seriously. Then he explained that he'd been the Democratic Kampuchea ambassador to North Korea, which I previously mentioned, but as I said, things got a bit tangential here and there. Now, contrary to some reports online, as I referenced at the start, there is some confusion because of code names and things like that. But Yayam survived the Democratic Kampuchea regime. As I said, he was sent to North Korea. He was the ambassador for Democratic Kampuchea in North Korea. But when the regime fell in 1979, he was recalled from North Korea and he joined the resistance movement in the 80s. Some reports online state that he was executed once he returned. That isn't the case, and perhaps this is due to, like I said, some of the confusion around code names. But Uncle relayed that Yam died at some point in the 1980s. He wasn't specific. That he died in Malai, which is, I'll show you on a map, right on the border with Thailand. I couldn't believe how close we were to Thailand on the drive to Malai. Like, it's literally just there. You just, all the mountains you see to the west is Thailand, and it's just there. We went past several border crossings, which at the moment were closed. So, yes, at some point in the 80s, in Malai, Yayam was an old man, and he died when a tree fell on his house. Quote, a big tree. I asked about his views of Yayam. Quote, he was the kindest person. He never looked down on people. He was respectful. And Khoi Tuon, someone that we've also mentioned in the podcast, someone that, if you've been paying attention, was one of the people that Pol Pot accused of plotting against him at that meeting with the Vietnamese at the end of 1970. But he said that Yam had been an associate of Khoi Tuon, had been his teacher. So I can only presume that it was actually Khoi Tuon that brought Yayam into the Khmer Rouge movement. As you'll remember, the Khmer Rouge had successfully infiltrated, I think is an appropriate enough word, a lot of the high schools and institutions around the country, and that's where they were finding a lot of recruits. And I think that it was probably Khoi Tuan who brought EAM into the movement. He also said that EAM had been influenced by another teacher, Keng Van Sak. This is someone we haven't talked about in the podcast for quite some time. He's kind of like a Khmer eccentric genius. He invented the Khmer typewriter. He was involved in socialist politics. He was highly influential on the students in France, seen as one of the big brothers in France. But he never truly joined the Khmer Rouge. Back to the story. In 1971, he was doing 6 month study at the camp in northern Kampong Thom and also spending 6 months in Krache. Then we did move forward a little bit. So presumably we kind of skipped over the period from 1971 kind of to 1975. And the impression I got that this 6 months on and then 6 months off thing was basically how Uncle operated during this period. In 1976, he was sent by Angkor to Phnom Penh. So 1976, we're talking after the Khmer Rouge have taken the country. So he's summoned by Angkor to Phnom Penh. And he worked or continued his study at the Khmer Soviet Friendship Hospital. This is in the southwest of Phnom Penh. I can show you where it is on the map if you're watching. I'll put it up here. It's just south of Mao Zedong Boulevard, west of the textile district. If you've ever spent any time in Phnom Penh, you've probably been to like the old Russian market. It's kind of west of there. And it's also about a 30-minute walk away from S-21, which in 1976 was in full operation. So this was a really fascinating part of the interview for me, because aside from it coming up in an other interview that I did with another doctor that perhaps I'll discuss another time, he was living in Phnom Penh. He would do 6 months at a time studying at the hospital to become a surgeon. He was a Khmer Rouge doctor. And he would continue doing this 6 months in Phnom Penh and 6 months back in his home province of Krache. Like I said, he was a surgeon. He said during his time in Phnom Penh, he was free to roam about. He said he didn't see soldiers, but he remembered the women working in the textile area making clothes. Now, that I found very interesting as well. Most people you hear of their accounts of living in Phnom Penh, usually they say that you couldn't walk to the end of a street without having, you know, permission from Cadre A to go to the end of the street to meet Cadre B. And it was quite strange for me to hear that he was seemingly able to roam around, particularly given, as I said, we're talking about a 30-minute walk from Tuol Slang, which was an area of the city that was particularly well-guarded and kept separate from everyone. It was also not that far from what we could term as a re-education center that was mostly ran by Yang Sari, where a lot of the intellectuals that had lived outside of Cambodia after the liberation, there were sort of calls to these people living outside Cambodia, hey, come back and help us. We need you. We need smart people like you to help the country. Most of them, when they arrived, their passports were taken and they were sent immediately for re-education. And many of them ended up at S21. Interestingly enough, I also conducted an interview with someone else who went through that same process, was not sent to S21, and ended up becoming Pol Pot's closest confidant and aide right up until his death, but a story for another time. So he's living in Phnom Penh, like I said, free to roam about, which I found strange. I asked if he was, you know, free to fraternize. He was a young man. I wondered if he was single or interested in pursuing relationships. He said he was focused on work. But he said that if he had wanted a relationship, you would tell a local leader who would arrange a meeting and a marriage. And he intimated that these marriages were consensual, which, of course, goes against much of what we know about the forced marriages of the Khmer Rouge. Again, I realize this is stuff we haven't covered in the podcast yet. Some of you will be aware of this, some of you will not. Let's just say that Uncle's perspective on these marriages being consensual and happily arranged goes quite against the grain of what, well, both survivors and historians would have to say about that. Another specific memory he had was about the lake, or what I presume he meant, or perhaps it didn't come across in the interpretation, is a river that, again, I'll show you where the Soviet Friendship Hospital is. There's a little river running just near there, and he specifically recalled that they were growing morning glory on that water for food. He said Phnom Penh was very quiet, but there was one big shop that was open, possibly Sat Thammai, the central market. He said it was near Monivong. And again, a lot of you may remember that the Khmer Rouge kind of had to cater to the ambassadors from other countries that were staying in Phnom Penh at their embassies. So they did actually have to have, you know, a shop so that they could go and get, you know, some whiskey or some ciggies, you know what I mean? He also remembered a huge gathering in 1975 with all of the top leaders. And it was there that they established clearly the goals for the country. 3 tons of rice per hectare, everyone will get 3 meals per day, and a dessert. This gathering lasted for 1 month. And again, this is confirmed in other sources. One book I always recommend to people that really want to get a proper grasp of the history of Democratic Kampuchea was a book edited and compiled from Khmer Rouge documentation called Pol Pot Plans the Future, edited by David Chandler, Ben Kiernan, and Chantal Bua. Now, the discussion jumped around a bit from here, but I will summarize his views in a way that sort of, as I said, I had to kind of rearrange things in a slightly more conventional way so they made sense to me for when I come back to use this as a source. I asked if his on and off trips. Remember, he's spending 6 months in Phnom Penh studying to be a surgeon, acting as a doctor. And then he would send he would spend 6 months in Crèche. And I asked whether he noticed whether things were getting worse. 6 months in Phnom Penh, 6 months in Crèche. Over the course of those trips, when he came back to his home province, did he notice things were getting worse? First, he said that from 1970 to 1975, everyone in Crèche was, quote, happy, and food was, quote, plentiful. He said that post-1975, so post the Khmer Rouge controlling the whole country, Yeams, remember that's his sort of teacher friend that had taken him under his wing. He said that Yeams' right-hand man had replaced him as zone leader. Now, here's where some more slight confusion can come in. Because according to Khmer Rouge Tribunal documents, Yeam was still the secretary of Crèche sector, which they confirmed as Sector 505, just as Uncle had said. But whether after Yeam was posted to North Korea and replaced with this right-hand man, it was hard for me to decipher whether that was to be just the secretary of Crèche itself or whether he was referring to what Crèche was part of the east zone of Democratic Kampuchea, which was under the control of someone named Sao Pim, who has come up in the podcast a fair bit as well. So, as I said, it seems that Crèche itself was part of the larger eastern zone, which was headed up by Sao Pim. But at this point in the discussion, Sao Pim's name hadn't come up, but we did talk about him later. And those that know what happens to Sao Pim will perhaps understand that foreshadowing. But Uncle's impression was that Crèche, until 1977, was still perfectly fine. So the right-hand man, whoever that was apparently held in high esteem by Uncle, and he seemed to think that everything was still running perfectly fine until 1977. Like I said, whether Crèche itself was administered by Yeam's right-hand man, who Uncle held in high regard, whether this was Sao Pim or someone else is unclear. I may need to look into this further, and perhaps I'll reach out to Craig Etchison directly about this. He might know. But Sao Pim died in 1978. So whether this right-hand man was replaced in 1977, where Uncle seems to think that everything started to go wrong from that point onwards, was left a little bit unclear. In any case, Uncle said Crèche was fine until 1977. Quote, people had three meals a day, nobody was suffering. The quote continues. People were not arrested. The only people who were thieves, murderers, or saboteurs. Until 1977, no one was murdered. He was, quote, 100% sure of this. However, he said he could only speak for Crèche. He didn't know what was happening in other provinces. But he pointed to that year, 1977, being when things changed. But he spent a lot of time speaking about Tarmac's forces and the purges. Now, Tarmac is someone that has come up in the podcast a lot, And I've been trying to foreshadow him as much as possible because he will become an extremely big part of the story. And as many of you will know that he earned the moniker Tarmok the Butcher. He recalled a time in 1977 when a team of Tarmok's forces who were in the Southwest Zone. Tarmok was in control of the Southwest. They had this reputation for being extremely loyal to Pol Pot, and in that sense, Pol Pot trusted them to carry out the purges of the people that he suspected were working against him. He said that a team of Tarmok's forces were fighting Vietnamese in Krachere in 1977. And following this fighting, when Tarmok returned to Phnom Penh, he said that there were widespread purges. This seemed to be the turning point in Uncle's mind. In the later 1978 East Zone purges, which, again, if you know the history, you'll know about the East Zone purges. If you don't worry, we will get there in the podcast one day. But essentially, the entire East Zone was suspected of being infiltrated, suspected, suspicious, due to their proximity with the Vietnamese and the long-term relationship that many of the zone leaders and cadres had with the Vietnamese. So for Pol Pot, when things were going wrong, he presumed that the people in the East Zone needed to be targeted. This seemed to be the turning point in Uncle's mind. In the later 1978 East Zone purges, he mentioned that his father was actually killed during these purges. He claimed that Pol Pot had been unaware of Tarmok's purges, and that once he did find out, he sent Mies Mut, the naval commander who, if you seriously know your history, you'll know he was accused in the Khmer Rouge tribunals of a variety of crimes, which was going to be, I believe, case 003, which ended up never going ahead. You can revisit my old interview with Craig Etchison, where we discussed exactly why that happened. In any case, he said that once Pol Pot had found out about what Tarmok was doing, he sent Mies Mut to go fight Tarmok's forces in the east. He said they were fighting Tarmok's Southwest Zone troops. Now, this was new to me. There is an ongoing conversation, let's say, about the factions in Democratic Kampuchea. But for someone to suggest that the East Zone purges, or that Tarmok's fighting of Vietnamese, or that any of that would have been happening without Pol Pot's knowledge, that was quite strange. Now, the sort of culmination of the East Zone purges, aside from tens of thousands of Khmer Rouge soldiers and cadre being taken away, executed in various prisons, taken S-21, killed out in Prey Vieng, Spray Ring, the culmination was that Sao Pim had become the focal point for suspicion for Pol Pot. He suspected a plot against him would come from Sao Pim, the leader of the Eastern Zone. Now, some people will know how Sao Pim died. He was surrounded, basically told to come to a meeting, and he knew what that meeting would be, and he took his own life. Uncle said that he eventually heard from the soldiers that he was treating in Phnom Penh about Sao Pim's suicide. He later wanted to emphasize a point very directly to me. Like, he looked me in the eye and said, "I want to make this very clear to you." And this gets kind of to that conversation about factions within the Khmer Rouge, which I am still, let's say, ambiguous about what I think. Various historians have various takes on this. My concern is that it was basically people like Non Chea, their defense at the Khmer Rouge tribunals was to point to this factionalism as a means of saying we had to be killing these people because they were threatening to overthrow us. So that is where some of my doubts come from about this. And friend of the show, Craig Etchison, in an article wrote that he felt that Pol Pot had a very centralized power over Democratic Kampuchea, and the idea of factions has been used by some in ways that maybe overstate exactly the extent to which they were in reality. In any case, Uncle really wanted to emphasize this point, as I said, directly to me. This is where he looked at me. There were two kinds of Khmer Rouge. There were the Khmer Rouge who loved Cambodia, and there were the Khmer Rouge who wanted to betray Cambodia. Now, within this sub-faction of those who wanted to betray Cambodia, there were those that were simply power-hungry and willing to lie and kill in order to advance their own positions. And there were also those who were involved in colluding with the Vietnamese, which, again, if you ever read Pol Pot's book that he wrote, the so-called Black Book about all of the crimes of Vietnam, he's quite, let's just say he emphasizes that point quite a bit. So, if I was to be empathetic to Uncle, and again, remember, he's a doctor, he's a surgeon, he's not out there killing people. He may have just been hearing things, and he may have just decided that one part of this story was the real story. So let's take him from his perspective. He also claimed that Pol Pot was unaware of much of this infighting, which, again, we're taking his perspective here, but let's just say there is an abundance of evidence that would suggest that Pol Pot knew exactly what was going on. And to suggest that he didn't realize there was this infighting doesn't really track with the history, particularly because he had essentially ordered the purges of the East and of various other zone leaders that he suspected were trying to betray him. Finally, as the interview drew to a close, Uncle disclosed something I found very interesting. He'd mentioned it earlier in the conversation, but I wanted to revisit it, and it makes sense to talk about it now. We've talked about his biography, and now we can talk about some of his reflections. What I found very interesting was that he said that he never really liked the communist movement. He preferred democracy. Direct quote. But he did know, quote, the movement was communist, and he knew he would be killed if he wasn't a communist. He pretended to like it. When I asked later if he felt that there were others that may have felt the same as him, that there was a general sense that people were pretending, and whether he knew that other people were like him, just pretending to be communists, and whether this was perhaps widespread. Specifically because he said he knew he would have been killed for this opinion. He knew that. So when I put it to him whether this was a wider thing, he kind of avoided the topic. He went on another quite long rant about tarmac, and at some point said that people, quote, just went along. So make of that what you will. I tried to press him on this. It didn't work. He went back to the East Zone purges once again, and he said that the Kasai, which we've mentioned in the podcast quite a lot, you have to imagine these patronage networks between people in Cambodia, he said that became an important function of accusation and murders, which is something that the anthropologist Alex Hinton really dives into in his book, Why Did They Kill?, which I recommend. Lastly, I asked him about slogans, in particular, the Super Great Leap Forward. Now, when I said that in English, my interpreter couldn't find the words for it. It took me a few minutes of actually going through some of my old answers I've put on Reddit, where I knew that at some point I had used the Khmer version of the Super Great Leap Forward, sometimes called the Prodigious Great Leap Forward. He said that this was a phrase, a slogan that he heard very commonly. Now, as I mentioned at the start, the interview went for quite a long time, and at this point, there is a degree of mental exhaustion that can come along with doing an interview like this. My questions in English, my interpreter having to interpret that, getting very long answers, and then my interpreter having to relay that back to me. It can take a lot out of you, especially, as I said, once you're going for more than a few hours. So at this point, we'd reached a natural end to the interview. But I have some thoughts. I have some thoughts about the interview that I want to share. And I've touched on some of these throughout, but I thought I would sort of conclude this with my my overall take on this particular interview. First of all, Uncle was really obsessed with tarmac. He basically blamed everything bad that happened on tarmac. And as I mentioned earlier, the implication of Mias Mut, a naval commander, again, from the sort of west, southwest, being sent to fight Tarmok's forces, I had never heard of that at all, and I will look into it. But hi everyone, please excuse if you're watching this the sudden change in the visual component. I wasn't going to try and fool you, my dear listener, by, you know, wearing the same shirt and trying to capture the same lighting. I'm not going to try and fool you. It's the next day. As you can tell, there's also a nice, lovely, soft Phnom Penh rain. So I hope that adds, if you can pick it up, just a slight little audible touch of authenticity here. Now, without going on like a wanker too much, I mentioned earlier that I would check in with Craig Etchison about some of these things. Now, having someone like Craig Etchison to check in with is like... Well, I tried to think of a few metaphors, but the metaphors don't really work when I can just say what it literally is, which is that he was part of the office which investigated the crimes of the Khmer Rouge, presented them to the courts, which then successfully prosecuted people like Norn Chair and Khieu Samphan and the rest of them. Well, most of them died on trial, but suffice to say, Craig Etchison is quite a good resource to be able to reach out to on something like this. I'd emailed him when I got back from my trip, and about an hour after finishing the recording last night, he got back to me, and some of the things he mentioned actually dovetailed quite well with what we're talking about in this video. So I'm cutting this bit in right here, and then we will cut back to my final thoughts that I will get to. But on the topic of, well, I'll just read verbatim what Craig said, and then we can sort of riff on that a little bit. As for his fond remembrance of Brother Number One, I would not put too much stock in that. Not that I would anyway, but back to Craig. I do believe that he could have been pleasant to be around, right up until he tells you that Brother Number Two would like to have a word with you. The two uncles you mention, that is the ones that I had mentioned in the email, sound like typical four surviving intellectual types from the Khmer Rouge. Now here's where he addresses precisely what I was just talking about with Tarmok and Mias Mut. Blaming Mok for everything going bad after the East Zone Purge is indeed quite rich. That was the part of the two final zone purges, East and West. And guess who ordered that? Pol Pot. As for Mias Mut, he and his two divisions, well, guess who they reported to? Tarmok. So this idea of Mias Mut fighting Tarmok in the East, a concoction, perhaps, a rumor, perhaps, a perspective that this particular uncle arrived at, and that's where we will leave it. But as for any suggestions that that may have been the reality, this isn't the case. And sometimes I don't feel like I need to spell this out to anyone, but just because I was around people that were saying Pol Pot was the nicest man they've ever met, we don't have to believe them on that either. It's just one of those things that you have to get used to. Okay, cutting back to past Lachlan now. The fact that he was certain about this led me to think that there were rumours. And we have to remember that the events that we're talking about occurred in 1978. And there were about 20 more years of the Khmer Rouge existing as an active insurgency in Cambodia, in Pailin, in Malai, in these places on the border. And I felt that perhaps his blaming of Tamok perhaps reflected his own Kasai, his own patronage networks. Perhaps he was closer to someone like Mias Mut, who may have given a different version of events than someone like Tamok. Tamok was basically, he inherited the end of the Khmer Rouge once Pol Pot died. He arrested Pol Pot after the old man ordered the brutal assassination of his long-term compatriot, Son Sen, who he had known since the 1950s, and had ordered his death as well as his family's death in a particularly brutal fashion, which I won't explain. But perhaps given that uncle seemed to think that Pol Pot was aloof of what was going on, that he was certain that things were going fine until 1977 and 1978, and he blamed, as I said, all of this on Tamok. Perhaps Tamok's arrest of Pol Pot, I think he used a term like Pol Pot is now, once he was cremated, he was worth less than dog shit or something to that effect. So perhaps Uncle, given his location in Pailin, perhaps he just knew other Khmer Rouge or ex-Khmer Rouge. And perhaps he took one side over the other. Like I said, perhaps he just believed some rumors and not others. And he took a side and he stuck to it. Like I said, we're just explaining his perspective here. Similarly, his nonchalance about living in Phnom Penh, being free to roam, not seeing soldiers, was at odds with what others have said. As I referred to what another uncle said, another doctor who was being trained at a different university, I think near the train station, near Monivong, near La Rayol, there's a university there. He was certainly not free to roam. He had a very strict schedule where he had to wake up, exercise, eat rice porridge, go to school, learn how to be a doctor, and go to bed. He wasn't free to roam. So hearing that this uncle was apparently free to roam was was, as I mentioned before, quite odd. But perhaps due to his connections to Yaim, who seemed to have a very prominent position, and perhaps because he was a surgeon, perhaps this did afford him more freedom in Phnom Penh than most others had. Again, we'll have to take his word for it. Lastly, his cognitive dissonance about knowing he would be killed for not being a communist, but at the same time being convinced that everyone was 100% fine, at least in Kratzer. I found that very interesting, that he knew he would be killed for his political opinion, which he was keeping to himself, and yet he didn't think that perhaps across the country people were being killed for their political differences to the Khmer Rouge ideology. I found it also very interesting just how close he was to S21. And I regret perhaps not asking him about that, but I have a feeling that he would have avoided the question. It's my understanding that a lot of these ex-Khmer Rouge guys, when you kind of push them in certain directions, they tend to find a way of avoiding really giving you a direct answer about some things. Also, he, like the others I interviewed, was adamant to avoid talking about politics, and my contacts were pre-warning me about this as well. Now, what I came to realize, and I mentioned this at the start, was politics didn't mean what happened in Democratic Kampuchea. Politics was about the relationship with Vietnam after the invasion and things to do with the government that took control of Cambodia after the Vietnamese invasion and decade-long occupation. This is what they didn't want to talk about. And they feared, in my perspective, they feared touching anything on that topic and that relationship. That seemed to still, for them, have a... I felt the connotation that if they said the wrong thing about the wrong people, that they could still be punished, which is why everyone I spoke to wished to remain anonymous. He did not want to take a selfie with me, which I was a bit sad about. I did get one selfie, but that was with another guy. Two selfies, actually. And lastly, this uncle, he struck me as very intelligent, sincere, and kind. Like I said, he just had his perspective. And to be honest, he seemed eager to tell his story. So, that was one of my interviews. I'm not going to do the same with the rest of the interviews I did. Like I've announced elsewhere, I will make sort of like a mini kind of video about my experiences in Pailin, Sam Lao, Malai, I had attempted to meet Pol Pot's daughter. I didn't meet Pol Pot's daughter, but I did meet someone else. And as I mentioned in one post on Patreon, there is a necessity for me to keep a low profile here. I don't want to get into it too much. I just don't want to talk about it generally. But I hope you understand that some of the things I'm doing here are still sensitive. And particularly with what's going on, there are certain topics that I will be avoiding, at least while I'm in the country, because I hope to keep my visa and be able to fly out of the country when I want to and not beforehand. So I hope that doesn't come across as me trying to hide anything. Nothing that came out of these interviews that was to do with politics is actually relevant to the work I'm doing. I'm writing a book about Pol Pot. I'm writing a history podcast about the Khmer Rouge. As much as I do take an interest in modern Cambodian politics, I would refer people to real journalists that are doing work on this subject rather than me, because my interest is the past and not the present. So I hope that doesn't sound like a cop-out, but it is a reality of the work I'm doing here, and as I found out, a reality that still affects some people. Overall, my last thing I'll say is that in the past, in Cambodia, I have only spoken with survivors. And for me, this was a very interesting experience to speak to people who were on the other side. And again, this is not about condemnation. This is not about judgment. This is just about history. And it is my job as a researcher of history to try and find out as much as possible. And some of the most valuable information you can get is from people who were on the bad side of the conflict. So I'll leave it there. I hope this little story made sense. I hope it was interesting. I hope it wasn't too jumping all over the place. But the last thing I'll say is that it was extremely interesting to meet someone who lived through the events that we've recently been talking about on the podcast, who was there, who heard Sihanouk's announcement, who joined the movement, and interestingly, didn't even like communism, but was part of the Khmer Rouge for 30 years. So I'll leave it there. I hope this was okay. If you've been watching this, I hope you enjoy the visual element. I feel like it's kind of like story time with Lachlan. And if you're just listening on the audio, I hope it sort of came across fine as well. Just a reminder that I'm releasing a lot of this stuff on Patreon. You don't have to subscribe, you don't have to pay, but you can watch it there ad-free. So if you're watching this on YouTube and you're annoyed by an ad like every 5 seconds, just click on the link below and you can watch this whole thing ad-free and then you don't have to complain about ads. And if you want to give me $2, that would be pretty cool. If you've already done that, and you are a Patreon subscriber, or if you've donated via PayPal, which so many of you have in the last week, and I apologize if I've not been able to message every single one of you directly. Like I said, I was doing this work and a lot of stuff was happening. I really do try and keep on top of that. I really do actually write all those personal messages as well. Like when you sign up to the Patreon, that is me like saying hi and thanks. So if you're already doing that, and if you've been supporting the show for a week, or in some cases, years, and you know who I'm talking about in those cases, I can't thank you enough. I feel like I'm doing what I am supposed to be doing with my life, and without your support, I wouldn't be able to be doing it. So I can't thank you enough. I hope you found this interesting. More to come, and trust me, I can't wait to get back to the regular program. And we'll get to 1972 very soon, I promise. But until then, get on the Patreon, get on the YouTube. I'm doing lots of little videos. Soon I'm going to Crank the Chan, this horrible prison out in Takeo. I visited Pol Pot's high school. I got lots of pictures there. I'm going to go to his hometown. I'm going to go to An Long Veng, where he died. And yeah, I'm going to have a whole thing about Ma Lai and Pai Lin. And I think, you know, I'm sorry that we're not just continuing the story. I wish we were, but this trip has been essential for me to write this book, and it's going to make the podcast better, and it's going to, now I've got a book. I was very worried about having to follow in the footsteps of David Chandler and Philip Short, but I'm growing in confidence. And I'm finding information that will be new and will bring a new perspective to this. And the last thing I'll say is that it's in one of the videos that you'll see that I released when I was walking around Pai Lin. But don't think that just because I was hanging out with ex-Khmer Rouge for a few days that I'm, you know, going to be getting the black pajamas on. Like I said, history is about just getting different perspectives and trying to find a story that matches reality as much as possible. So interviews like this are essential. And if you're supporting the podcast, you're helping me contribute to the history, and I can't thank you enough. So good night, good morning, wherever you may be. I'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.